This past Wednesday night, I had the opportunity to travel to Tibby, Alabama, a little town just north of Citronelle, and had the opportunity to go to Tibby Baptist Church and to preach in, as a part of their awesome August celebration, in which they invite pastors and preachers from outside of the church to come each Wednesday night and to bring a message. And it was my honor and delight to go there this past Wednesday. I batted in the cleanup position, the fourth of four to come and to preach, and had a great time. It was a wonderful time to meet up with some new friends and some old friends in that place. And I preached a sermon that my wife convinced me to reprise this morning. I had thought about going back to Joshua and just sort of leaving this, and then I realized, no, probably this needs to be repeated here as well. And so this morning I'm going to attempt to reprise a message that I delivered on Wednesday night. Now, this particular sermon has its genesis all the way back in 2007. I had the privilege back then of preaching at a conference of fundamentalist Baptist pastors in Missouri. And I had preached a sermon on Christology in the church at that time. And so when Pastor Woody asked me to come to Tibby and to preach, I began to think about, okay, what am I going to preach on? Okay, I'm not a topical preacher, as you know. And so finding a topic has never been an easy thing for me to do. So I started looking through my website, particularly through the section on churches, because I've always sort of fancied myself an ecclesiologist. And thought, okay, maybe there's something in that list that I need to do. And I noticed that particular sermon from 2007, but there was no audio associated with it. Apparently, it didn't get recorded, so there was an outline sitting there. And so I thought, well, maybe this would be a chance to repeat that sermon and at least get some audio to it. So I began looking at the outline and realized there was no way that I could preach that sermon now, because too many things have changed since 2007. In the past 14 years, so many things have changed that many of the things I'm going to say to you this morning could not have been said then, because they would not have been even remotely considered 14 years ago, just 14 years ago. So I'm going to come and make the same point that I made in that sermon, but I'm going to come to it in an entirely different way. I'm going to take an entirely different approach to get to the same exact point, because the point is still valid. But the means of getting there needs to change along the way. And I'm going to start with my own opinion of something. And my opinion is this. I believe that we are living in a time of unprecedented judgment by God upon our nation. Now, I realize some of you may still think that you can sing God Bless America and hope that He will. In my opinion, however, I don't think that's relevant anymore. I think we're living in a day of judgment. I think that God is now judging America and all of the West by lifting His hand of restraint from us, which is very consistent with the pattern outlined in the book of Romans, chapter 1. In other words, I am convinced that the judgment upon America is there, that it's real, because the parallels between what's happening in America and what you see in Romans 1 are unbelievably aligned. There's simply no way to get around this. Let me give you just a brief snapshot of this. Okay, in Romans chapter 1, as Paul starts that great indictment of the human race in Romans 1, starting at 18, going to verse 32, he starts by noting that men first begin by suppressing the knowledge of their Creator. They suppress the fact that there is a Creator, and the result of that is they become futile in their thinking. They can't think straight anymore. Their minds no longer are able to process information in a way that leads to right and logical conclusions. And so they begin to worship the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. They start to think about themselves being autonomous from God, and they begin then to become futile in the way that they think. And nowhere do we see this more evidently is in the fact that today, men teach that human beings are nothing more than evolved animals. That we are nothing more than, as one commentator put it, fizzing bags of chemicals. We have no transcendent purpose or intention. We're born into this world. We have a few experiences. We die. That's the end of it. We have no purpose. We have no existence outside of this mortal existence here. And the result of that is two or three generations of school children being taught this to the point where, and I read this just this week, a poll done just this week and published, now indicates that 62% of Americans believe that the theory of evolution is a fact. It's no longer a theory amongst 62% of Americans. For most of the 60 years that I've been on this planet, it's hovered right about 50-50. When I was a child, it was about 30% believed it, and about 70% did not. But there is a rise in the number that are now believing that we have no purpose and intention other than just being evolved animals. And we've been teaching children this for quite some time. And then following that, according to Paul's pattern, God gives them up or over to every kind of physical and sexual impurity. The sexual revolution of the 60s and the 70s morphed and spawned into the great moral revolution that we are now in the midst of, leading even to the establishment of so-called gay marriage in our society, that a man can have a husband, that the Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg, can have a husband and be a parent. And this is accepted. This is accepted as normal in our society. This is God giving us up to every imaginable kind of physical and sexual impurity, to homosexuality being mainlined, and even now to the point where the worst form of rebellion, in my opinion, now becomes standard and normalized and mainstreamed when men and women stand and shake their fists at the heavens and say, I will not even be the sex you made me to be. First, men suppress the knowledge of their Creator and they become futile in the way that they think. And then he gives them over to every imaginable kind of physical and sexual impurity. And then at the end of the chapter, Paul goes on to say that God gives them up, gives them over to a depraved mind. Not just futile thinking, but a depraved mind and every kind of wickedness. The absolute insanity of the thinking process all around us, where that which is good is now considered evil, and that which is evil is now considered good. The absolute insanity of the thinking process in our politics, in the academic world, in the media, in entertainment, in pop culture, and even in many parts of the church, including men who stand up and say unbelievably wicked, racist things in the name of anti-racism. That's depraved thinking. And Paul even ends that chapter by pointing out that not only do men have depravity of thinking and every imaginable form of wickedness, but they also entice other men to do that as well so that they will feel better about the fact that they're wicked. They know that people that do such things deserve to die, but they want others to do them as well. You see, there's no escaping the reality that what we are seeing in the last 60 years of American life, this exact spiral of God giving them over, giving them over, giving them over. America is experiencing vividly the downward spiral of judgment. It is obvious. If you will look and you will see it, it is obvious. Let me put before you, let me remind you of something that I've said many times. This was new to the people at Tibby, but something that I've said to you many times, and that is this, that judgment is God giving to a man what he wants. Judgment is God giving to a man what he wants. For the reprobate man desires to be autonomous. The reprobate man wants to be separate from God. He wants to be out from under the restrictions of the law of God. He wants to be God, and he wants to make up the rules for himself. The reprobate man wants the lie of the Garden of Eden to be true. He wants it to be true that you will be God. That's what he wants. He wants that lie to be true. He wants to be able to shake off the constraints of holiness demanded by his Creator to do whatever his fleshly and wicked, rebellious heart wants him to do. He wants nothing to do with God. He wants to be free of God. He wants to indulge every form of wickedness that his flesh can conjure up. And so God gives him what he wants. That's the message of Romans chapter 1. God gives them up. But not only does God give them up to what they want, but he also gives them up to the consequences of what they want. Which is why I've said, and you've heard me say many times, that hell is going to be God giving to the reprobate man what he wants. All right? You want to be free of me? You want to be free of my restraints? Fine. I will lift my hand of mercy and restraint from you. I will remove all compassion and grace from you. And I will allow you to be, I will turn you over to what you really are. And men will go into hell hating God with every fiber of their being. And there will be no restraint upon them by God. No mercy, no compassion. Nothing over them to prevent them from hating God fully as their heart desires. That's hell. The worm that will never die and the fire that will never be quenched is their hatred of the living God and the fact that they can never be what they want to be. Because they can never make themselves into God. They will never exist as God. They will always be creatures with rebellious hearts that hate God. James White puts it this way. He says, you could pluck a man out of hell 10,000 years after he's been there, smoking from the fire, set him in a chair, and ask him, will you now submit yourself to the law of God and love God? And that man will get up and walk back into hell. That's judgment. America wants to be free from God. The people want to be free from God. The politicians and the academics and so much more want to be free from God. So God is giving to this nation exactly what it wants. It has wanted no God, and it has wanted sexual freedom for a very long time. And so God has said, fine, you can have it. I will give it to you. And the consequences that go with it. The consequences of such a desire, then, is a freight train of destruction coming at us. The economic woes that we are beginning to see are only the tip of the iceberg of what is coming. Our global loss of moral authority in the world. I mean, do the events of the last couple of weeks stamp out once and for all the fact that we are no longer the moral compass of the globe? Foreign invasion. Loss of cohesion as a nation. Corrupt leadership. The corruption of leadership, by the way, in this country, you have no idea what it really looks like. It is hidden well from you, but it is deep. And a scourge, a plague of mental illness that has descended upon this nation. I've watched TikTok videos, much to my chagrin, of people looking into their cameras on their phone and calling themselves, what's the term they use now? Libra gender? I don't know what this is, but it's apparently that your gender can change moment by moment, that you can be male for an hour and then female and then asexual and then whatever. And they say it with a straight face. 10 years ago, these people would be carted off to the loony bin and need medication. But today, they're championed as the heroes of a culture that has lost its mind. Mental illness is running rampant. And we can't stop it. And I'm convinced, even if I might be so bold, as to suggest that the continuing nature of this pandemic is an active part of this judgment. I'm convinced that God has layered upon us not only what we want, but has added a scourge on top of it in order to put people into fear. Fear now is the ruling emotion of the people of this country. We are terrified of a disease that has a 0.5% chance of killing you. Now, I'm not dismissing and downplaying those who have been sick or died. But if we're going to compare and contrast COVID to the Black Plague in Europe, we haven't come close. Because in Europe, in the 14th and 15th century, when the plague went through, 40% of the population died. If 40% of the population in the United States died from COVID, 120 million people would be dead. You would know every third person dead if this were a real epidemic. But no, what is it? It's an epidemic of fear. It's an epidemic of, we're terrified. We can't even move. How many of you find yourself walking down the street and seeing someone come towards you and kind of step aside a little bit? Okay, let's give him a little space. You know, because he might kill me if he walks by. This is ridiculous and preposterous, but it has become us. I am convinced that what God is doing is layering upon us an active part of His judgment for people to cower in fear because they know death means judgment and standing before a holy God. And so He gives them what they want. The consequences of their actions are not only do they do these things, but they give hearty approval to those who do them. Even though they know that people who do such things deserve to die. Now that's the reality of the world in which we live. I know you may disagree with me and still think that America is a great nation, but the parallel is unmistakable here. So that leads us to a question, and it's a very important question that we should be asking. And that question is this. How are we, as the church, as followers of Jesus Christ, to pass through this judgment? Maybe some of you have already started asking this question. If there's judgment all around us, then there's no doubt about it, then the natural question becomes, how do we, as followers of Christ, how do we, as those who know this God and love this God, how do we pass through this judgment? How will we as the remnant survive as judgment sweeps us up with the wicked? Because that's what happens, unfortunately. As so many discovered in the days of Israel when they went off into the Babylonian captivity, the righteous were swept up with the wicked. How will we pass through this judgment? Now, one of the biggest problems that we have, of course, is that much of this cultural wickedness has already penetrated the church. It's already become a part of the culture of so much of the church today. There's massive sexual confusion today in the church. Baptist churches may not be embracing homosexuality, but we're struggling with gender identities of all kinds in the church today. So how does the true church, a church that wants to be faithful to the Lord, wants to be faithful to His Word, how does that church that desires to be faithful go through this time? How do we pass through this judgment? Now, the popular answer to that question, and there are many who are asking that question. Some of the most popular names in Christendom today are asking that question. But what we find in many of the answers that are given is in the popular answer is that the church will need to find ways to exist outside, if you will, of the cultural milieu. We will have to figure out how to live in the world but not of the world, in the sense that we will need to develop communities in which Christians can support one another in unique ways. One of the leading voices of this particular advocation is a man by the name of Rod Dreher. Dreher has written two books, both of which I have read. The first, known as The Benedict Option, came out a few years ago. It was followed up last year by a book called Live Not by Lies. The fundamental point of both of these two books is a diagnosis of the reality I just said, that America is sliding down the hill into what he calls soft totalitarianism, a sense in which it won't be a hard totalitarianism coming from government, but a soft totalitarianism coming from the media and from the business world, in which it will attempt to enforce the orthodoxy of this new way of thinking upon all. That's a soft totalitarianism. And his antidote to that, which came out in the first book, The Benedict Option, is to take the approach that Benedict did. Benedict was a monk that lived in the early days or the later days of the imperial church, establishing a community outside of the normal community of life. Men and women who would get up and leave society and go find an abbot somewhere and gather together and have a little community. Now, Dreher is not himself advocating that we must withdraw from society in that way. But what he is advocating is we're going to have to start thinking in that way. How do we understand ourselves being in the world but not of the world? And by the way, that's my term, Jesus' terms, not his terms. That's the popular answer. His solutions are very practical in nature. But I think that there is a deeper problem that must be addressed first. It's okay to have practical solutions, and many of these practical solutions I resonate with. I think he's right. What are we going to do, for example, when Amazon says, look, you can't have a Prime membership anymore if you don't check the box on our LGBTQ thing? All right? That's coming. It's only a matter of time. It's coming. Okay? How are we going to deal with that? What are we going to do in the fact that we can't participate in the largest shopping network in the world? What are we going to do? How are we going to deal with that? Okay. True. We're going to have those practical solutions in place. We're going to have to figure that out. We're going to have to address that. But the deeper problem needs to be addressed first. Because let me put it like this. As I said a moment ago, if the church is already being infiltrated by many of these cultural ideas, and then we simply take those ideas with us as we go into our little communities, have we really solved the problem? No, we're just taking them with us. If we already have gender confusion in the church and we try to withdraw into our little communities, aren't we going to just be bringing our gender confusions with us? And the answer, of course, I believe is yes. So if we're already struggling with this, do we not need a deeper solution? And frankly, to be honest with you, I'm not sure that Dreher can really give an answer to the question that I'm proposing, because as a former Catholic who's converted to Orthodoxy, I'm not sure that he can provide a theological answer to the question. And he doesn't anywhere in his two books. Not a hint of it. So instead of a practical answer, let me suggest to you a Christological answer. Okay? Let me suggest to you a Christological answer to that. And this is my thesis. The true church passes through judgment by being utterly centered on Jesus Christ, where He and He alone is the absolute object of affection for its members, and where obedience and loyalty to Him are paramount. Now, let me say that again. We will pass through judgment only as we keep our eyes and our hearts and our minds fixed upon Jesus Christ, where He is the most important thing to us, where our absolute affections are in Him, not in the things of this world, but in Him. And we put ourselves into a place of absolute allegiance and loyalty to Him and to Him alone. In other words, when we adopt a proper Christology in the church, when we adopt a focus so much upon Him that we pass through this judgment, keeping our minds, eyes, and ears focused on Christ Jesus. Now, to prove this thesis, I'm going to take you to a familiar, very familiar passage of Scripture. I'm going to take you to Matthew chapter 16. Now, I'm not going to exegete all of what I'm going to look at this morning. Don't have time to do that. But I'm going to use it as a framework to make my point. I'm going to use the words of Jesus Himself to establish the point that I'm making. And there may be some things in here that you had not thought of before. It will help you see where the point is going. Matthew chapter 16, starting in verse 13. Jesus, I'm paraphrasing now, Jesus comes to his disciples and he says, "Who do men say that the Son of Man is?" Now, we know he's talking about himself, right? Son of Man is a euphemism for himself. So let's just rephrase it. Who do men say that I am? Who do men say that I am? I can almost imagine the disciples of Jesus, Peter, James, John, and the others, sheepishly looking at each other and, well, some people think that you are that you are returned Jeremiah, one of the prophets. Or some assume that you are returned Elijah. You know, he didn't die. Maybe you've just come back as him. Maybe you're just him. Or some have suggested that you're a resurrected John the Baptist, even. That, you know, John's dead, but now here you are, back again. Now, let's fast forward that to today. Who do men say that Jesus is today? When you ask, who do men say that Jesus is? In secularism, in the religion of secularism, make no mistake about it, it is a religion, Jesus is an ahistorical holy man. Maybe he lived, maybe he didn't, but he's just a holy man of some sort. In Islam, he is a prophet, but less than Muhammad. He's in the line, but he's less than Muhammad. In Catholicism, Jesus is a mystical piece of bread that you take upon your tongue in the Mass. In Eastern Orthodoxy, Jesus is a vision of God as an image to be worshipped. In liberalism, Jesus is a social justice warrior that's come to solve all of our oppressive problems with one another. In evangelicalism, he's a friend, a buddy, a pal in time of need. He's your personal friend that you've asked into your heart in some sort of mystical way. In Pentecostalism, he's a ticket to prosperity. He's a meal ticket to every good thing you could ever imagine. See, it's exactly the same question and the exact same response. Who do men say that I am? Nobody knows. Nobody knows. Nobody really knows who this Jesus is. You ask 50 different people, you're going to get 50 different answers to who he is, depending upon their background. Same exact thing in Jesus' day when he asked his own disciples. You ask the same question of disciples of Jesus today, you get the same kind of answers. Because men see Jesus as they want to see him. Men see Jesus as what they want him to be. Never mind who he actually is. Men see Jesus in the framework of whatever they want him to be. So Jesus then asks the $64,000 question. Who do you say that I am? Now that's a very different question, isn't it? I don't care what those people think. What do you think? Who do you think Jesus is? It is this question that's at the heart of my thesis. It's this question that answers how we pass through judgment. How do we understand Jesus? It is this question which launches Peter to stand up and say, with his great confession, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." That is a foundational confession of who Jesus really is. That is a foundational and fundamental confession of who Jesus really is. He's not a human ideal, right? He's not some idea that you've made up in your minds as you've considered this Jesus from whatever background and experiences you have. No, this is a confession that makes Jesus to be what he reveals himself to be. Not a human ideal, but God himself. Jesus even turns to him and says, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven." Jesus says to him that the only reason that you're able to know this is because it's been revealed to you. Not because you read it in a book, or not because you heard it from some pastor, or not because it's a part of your tradition, but because it was revealed to you by the living God Himself. You've come to understand, and we come to understand, as the fullness of this revelation comes out, because I'm not sure how much of this Peter really understood. But we can, looking through the fullness of the revelation of the New Testament, we can know that this is a confession, that the man standing before Peter is Yahweh in the flesh. God incarnate, the Creator in person, standing in front of him and speaking to him, God Himself. And this understanding of Jesus is only available to those to whom it's been revealed. So Jesus connects this great confession to the church. See it? To the church. You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell, gates of Hades, will not prevail against it. The church is an organism built upon this confession of faith at its core, that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. It's not built upon Peter, as our Catholic friends insist, as though some sort of play on words reveals that Peter, otherwise known as Petra, is the actual foundation of the church. An irony given the fact that Jesus was not speaking Greek, probably, at this particular moment, and the play on words doesn't exist in the Aramaic. Not to mention the fact that just one paragraph later from this, which we'll get to in a second, Jesus has to call the same man Satan. No. The true foundation of the Church of Jesus Christ, the true foundation of the church, is this confession that Jesus is Yahweh in the flesh. A proper Christology in the church begins with a true understanding of who Jesus has been revealed to us to be. The revelation that Jesus is Yahweh in the flesh is the foundation, what some writers in the New Testament call the cornerstone, as he himself even called himself, the cornerstone of the church. The confession is the rock, him, upon which the entirety of the church is built. You understand what I just said? You understand the ramifications of what I just said? You and I will only pass through this judgment by truly knowing who Jesus is. We need to be prepared to answer that question correctly. Who do men say, or better, who do you say that I am? A proper Christology always begins with an understanding of who Jesus is, ontologically. But Jesus goes on in the next paragraph, 21 to 23. He begins now to speak about the fact that he is going to Jerusalem, where he's going to be handed over to the religious leadership, and he's going to be crucified and to die. Right? And ironically, it's Peter who comes to Jesus and rebukes him for saying this. No, that's not going to happen to you. No. We understand what the Messiah really is all about. The Messiah is going to be the one who's going to come, and he's going to throw off Roman oppression. He's going to seat himself on the throne, and he's going to establish all of us as his followers, and we're all going to have great prosperity, and Israel once again is going to be reestablished as a nation. No. This idea of you going to a cross, forget it. That's not going to happen. No, I'm sorry. That's a deep paraphrase. But it's what Peter was thinking. No. You're not going to go down the path of suffering. You're going to go down the path of exaltation. And Jesus has to turn to this man who just made this great confession, has to turn to him and say, "Get behind me, Satan." Now, whether he was actually talking about Peter or talking about Satan behind Peter, I don't know. But what I do know is this. Peter has to be rebuked because he does not want Jesus going down the path that he wants. He doesn't want him going down the path that Jesus is set to go on. He doesn't want Jesus going down a path of suffering and death, but another path. You see, people want a Jesus that solves our earthly problems. They want a Jesus who is a friend to them. They want a Jesus who makes their life fulfilling. They want a Jesus who solves their problems. As I said earlier, they want a Jesus made in their own image. And thus they want a Jesus who does what they want Him to do. But to expect Jesus to act according to our purpose and desire, other than what He was sent to accomplish, is utterly satanic. See what I just said? To expect Jesus to do what you want Him to do because of your image of who He is utterly satanic. It is the lie spun from the depths of hell that you get to dictate to Yahweh in the flesh what Yahweh in the flesh is supposed to do for you. A proper Christology in the church begins with an understanding of who Jesus truly is, but it continues with a true understanding of what Christ came to do as He was sent by the Father. Those two things are inextricably linked together. You cannot know the true Jesus in terms of who He is if you don't also know who the true Jesus is in terms of what He came to do. Jesus has come not to bring us happiness, but to satisfy the deepest need that we have. He has come to satisfy our sin and death problem. He's come to make us righteous before the Father. He's not come to make your life happy. He's not come to make your life good. No. He has come to solve the real problem of your life, the one we most often ignore, which is our sin. And the fact that we will die. The Christian passes through the judgment by truly knowing what Jesus did. Now, I find it absolutely fascinating the way Matthew put this together. I don't know if Jesus did this in this order, but Matthew recounts it in this order. First, you see this great confession of Peter as Jesus comes and asks, "Who do men say that I am? And then who do you say that I am?" Right? And then he turns at that point and begins talking about where he's going. He's going to the cross, and he has to rebuke Peter for his trying to deflect that, defer that. But then Matthew records this next sentence almost immediately after this. What's the next thing he says? Verse 24. "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." Jesus tells His disciples that the true way for a Christian to follow Him is to deny himself, to take up his cross. Other books put the word daily in there. Take up your cross daily and follow Him in obedience. You see, the call of Christ upon us, the call of the Christian, is a call to self-martyrdom. The call of Christ is a call to self-martyrdom. To walking the path of death. The call of Christ is not a call of an invitation for you to come and accept Jesus into your heart. It's not a call for you to join a church or to be baptized. Those things are important, but that's not the call. Faith is not some feeling that you have in your heart. No. The call of Christ is a call to us to empty our hands of everything else and take a hold of a cross, an instrument of death, and get on the road to our own martyrdom. That's what it's a call to. It's a call to death. To follow Christ in utter obedience, as He did along the Via Dolorosa. Make no mistake about it. When Christ carried that cross down that road to Calvary, He was performing the single greatest act of obedience in the history of the world. Going to death. as his father had commanded him to do. That's called obedience. When Jesus takes up a cross, he does so in obedience. When you take up a cross, you do so in obedience. We know what the end is, but we do it anyways. To die to self and be conformed to the image of Christ, which is holy. A pursuit not of happiness, but a pursuit of holiness in utter, abject obedience and allegiance to Christ as Lord. Speaking of Dreher, I read his blog on a regular basis. He writes for the American Conservative. And this week he wrote a blog post about a man who sent him a letter, which he reproduced. And in this letter, the man speaking is an administrator in a university somewhere. And this man decides to hire this woman who apparently he knows and believes that she's qualified to take on the post that he's hiring her for. But he also knows that she is a professed lesbian. So he hires this woman, he brings her in, and on the very first day that this woman comes to the office, she comes to this man and she says, "I know that you are a Christian and you used to be a pastor. I'm a lesbian and I'm a Christian. What do you think of that? Do you think that I'm a Christian?" And this man says in his letter, basically, "I put my fate in her hands and I told her the truth." Now, he doesn't outline what he said, but I imagine something to the effect of lesbianism is a violation of the very imago Dei, the very reality of God creating us male and female, and you need to repent of that. She filed a Title IX complaint against him, and he was fired from his job. And Rod, in his blog post, after this post in this letter, writes this. And I quote, "He should never have answered that woman's question, obviously," unquote. My friends, such a response is utter cowardice. For Dreher to suggest that this man shouldn't have spoken to her because of her obvious woke ideology is basically cowardice. Because it's to say that we are not supposed to speak of these things with those who might disagree with us, because there's always the possibility of danger in mind. That, my friends, is not obedience to Christ. Christ says, "Take up a cross and follow after me." And if that means speaking the truth to a lesbian in your university administration, and she files a Title IX complaint against you and gets you fired, so be it. That's what loyalty and obedience and allegiance to Christ implies. That's what it means to carry a cross. The follower of Christ is called to articulate such offensiveness when confronted by the wickedness all around us. This is obedience and loyalty to Christ. And yes, the consequences may even be to our physical death. But such is the call of the Christian from Christ. A proper Christology in the church begins with us knowing who this Jesus is. It continues with knowing what he has come to do. Not what we want him to do, but what he's come to do. And then thirdly, and most importantly, to advocate what Christ demands of us in the gospel. A true Christology is a call that Jesus places over us to follow him in utter loyalty and allegiance, even if it means we lose everything in this world. He did. He did. We're called to it as well. The Christian passes through the judgment by truly knowing what Jesus demands. Not only who he is, and what he's done, but what he demands. Now, let me bring all of that back to the principle I brought you earlier. Remember, I said that judgment is God giving to a man what he wants? That when God takes a reprobate, when God judges a reprobate man, the reprobate man wanting to be autonomous, wanting to be out from under the restrictions of the law of God, he wants to be God, and he wants to make up his own rules for living, and so God gives him what he wants, along with the consequences of that? That's judgment. God lifts his hand of restraint, his hand of mercy, his hand of love, and he sends the man away to gnash his teeth for all eternity over the fact that he will never be God and he will never experience good again. Ever. In any way. Because God lifts all of his compassion. The man will be in that place utterly alone with no other relationships other than the wrath of God over him. Because he will shake his fist at God forever. And God gives him that because that's what he wants. But there's a flip side to that coin. And it goes like this. What does God give in his judgment to the man who's been born again? Have you ever asked that question? I must confess, it's new to me. If God's judgment is to give a man what he wants, then what does he give to the man who is the new creation in Christ? What does he give to the man whose heart of stone has been replaced by a heart of flesh? What does he give to the man who's truly been born again by the Spirit of the living God and called to Christ? What does he give that man? And the answer is that such a man who possesses a heart that loves Jesus is given Jesus. Jesus. You see, the elect man desires to know Christ. He knows what God has revealed because the only person who can truly know who this Jesus is, according to our Lord Himself, is the man who's been revealed to know it. He knows this because the Spirit of the living God has taken out that old heart of stone and put in a heart that loves God. A heart in which it's said that God Himself writes His law on it, such that that heart loves the law of God and desires to do good and be righteous and holy. What does God give to this man? He gives him what he wants. And what does he want? He wants Jesus. The primary love of the newborn heart is Christ Jesus Himself. And that's what God gives in judgment to the born again. Revelation chapter 20 speaks of the great white throne judgment seat of Christ where all humanity will be drawn before Him. I don't care what your eschatology is, whether dispensationalist or postmodern, it doesn't matter. There's going to come a day when every single man in this world is going to stand before Christ. He's going to be seated on His great white throne and He's going to separate the sheep to His left. The goats to His left. That would have been awkward. The goats to His left. Now some of you will get that. And the sheep to his right. And the sheep on his right are those who have three things true about them. Number one, they know who he is. They know who he is. They recognize him. When someone needed a cup of water, they saw him. They saw him. They know what he's done. They're clinging to His atonement with every ounce of their strength. They're standing there with an empty hand. I got nothing. I know what you did, though, when you went to the cross on my behalf. So I come with nothing. You are everything. They know who he, they know what He's done. They know who He is. They know what He's done. But their lives also demonstrate an unyielding allegiance to Him in obedience. Not perfectly. Don't make the mistake of thinking I'm talking here about perfection. I'm not. But their lives demonstrate an unyielding allegiance to Him in obedience. When the books, plural, read that passage in Revelation 20. When the books, plural, are opened, every man is judged for what's written in the books. And what's written in the books? Everything they have done in this life. And the reprobate man, his life shows what? Nothing but rebellion and hatred of God. All of the works written in the books about the man who is reprobate demonstrates he hated God all of his life. But for the elect man, there's a thread running through those works. There's a thread. And it's imperfect because we don't see it, but he can see it. And what it demonstrates is that in the life of that individual, he sees a love for himself. Oh, it's imperfect, but it's there. Why? Because the Spirit of the living God is there in that thread. The books are opened and they all demonstrate either one of two things. Either the person hated Christ and feigned any sort of obedience to Him, or the man loved Christ and pursued Him in obedience. We pass through the current judgment coming against us in this culture and in this society in the same way. We pass through the judgment of this day in exactly the same way as those who will stand before Christ. See, we need to be more than countercultural in how we survive. Community's fine. We'll figure out some of these practical solutions. And yes, we'll be doing some of these things. But it's much more important that we're countercultural in how we understand Jesus. We need to be countercultural in how we say to the world the answer to the question, who do you say that He is? We need to be ready to stand up and say, we understand who this Jesus truly is. And that is how we will pass through this judgment. We need to be so centered on Christ, so Christocentric in our thinking, that we clearly stand out from the world. We must be different from the world around us in one particular way: how we understand Him. Not how we understand religion and the practice of religion. No, how we understand Him, because it's about Him. It's not about what we do. It's about what He did. It's not about what we are. It's about what He is. Our lives need to be countercultural in our understanding of Christ so that we offer to the world a countercultural message to those living around us. And though they may kill us for it, God will give us the desire of our heart. He will give us Jesus. In too many evangelical circles, the pursuit is heaven. The pursuit is heaven. Getting to some place with streets of gold and big mansions and whatever, and good mailing addresses, I guess. But that's not the goal. That's a secondary side effect way down the list. What does the Christian truly want? The Christian wants Him. Him. And God will give us the desire of our heart if and only if it actually is the desire of our heart. That is how we pass through this judgment, my friends. There's no magic cure for us in the days of judgment upon a nation, except one. And that is, we need to be absolutely sure that we and the church around us has embraced a full and proper Christology in order to stand firm in this day of judgment in pursuit of one thing.